Special lecture, May 25th, 1963, Curved Space. Special lecture, May 25, 1963, Curved Space. Special lecture, May 25th, 1963, Curved Space.
This lecture was originally designed to be the grand finale of the sophomore course, the last lecture in the sophomore course, but I'm not very good at this stuff, and I didn't plan things right. I got all botched up in sophomore course, and I haven't even got enough lectures to finish what I'm talking about, and so I decided to continue on the quantum mechanics that I'm teaching to the very last lecture, but I already made up this one for the last one, so I give it to you for nothing. So I didn't want to waste it, so I will give you the lectures on curved space. According to Newton, everything attracts everything else by force inversely proportional to the square of the distance between them, and they respond by accelerating toward each other to this force, and that accounts, as you know, for the motions of balls, planets, satellites, galaxies, and so forth. And that's the law of gravitation. Einstein has a different interpretation of the law of gravitation. If the sophomores feel that this is extremely low class, remember there are freshmen in the audience. If the freshmen feel that this is entirely low class, remember there are guests in the audience. And also sophomores. Einstein has a different interpretation of the gravitational effects. According to him, space and time, which we put together as space-time, is curved near heavy masses like the sun, and it's the attempt of things to go straight in this curved space-time, which produces the peculiar motions, the attempt to go straight in this curved world that makes them move the way they do. Now, that is a complex idea. A very complex idea, and I would like to explain the idea. It involves three parts. It involves a relation to gravitation. It involves the idea of space-time, which you have already studied, of course. But it involves the idea of curved space-time. What is meant by curved? Well, I'm going to simplify it in the beginning by not discussing the gravity and leaving out the time and discussing just curved space. I'll finish in the lecture. I'll talk about the other parts also, but we'll concentrate on the idea of curved space. What is meant by curved space? More specifically, what is meant in this application of Einstein by curved space? Now, even that turns out to be somewhat difficult in three dimensions. So I even reduce the problem still further and talk about two dimensions. I'm going to describe what is meant by the words curved space in two dimensions. For somebody lives in two dimensions. In order to work to understand this, you've got to really appreciate the limited point of view of the character who lives in two dimensions. We imagine a bug who lives on this plane here. I won't try to draw the physiognomy of the bug. The bug is represented this way. And he moves around on the plane. There's a whole society, these bugs. They live on a plane, but they really live on a plane. They don't know that there's any way to look outside. They haven't got your imagination. What we're going to do is by analogy. We remember we live in a three-dimensional world, and we don't have any imagination about going off of our three-dimensional world in a new direction. So we have to think the thing out by analogy. It is as though we were bugs living on a plane, and there were a space in the other direction. So that's why we work with a bug, and we have to remember he lives on his surface, and he can't get out. So in this blackboard, the bug lives on a plane. It's a two-dimension. That makes sure that it's two dimensions. Now, the next example of a bug living in two dimensions is a bug who lives on a sphere. I have a sphere here. I imagine that there's bugs that live on the surface of a sphere and go always on the sphere, and they can't look up or down or out of the sphere. They walk around on the sphere. And so we'll put in this other blackboard here the behavioral observations, which we call bugs B. They live on a sphere. And now I have a third class of creatures, also bugs and so on. They live on a plane too, like the bugs, but they, best way to describe it, they have hot rulers. What I mean is this, that in different places on this plane, the temperature is different. Suppose, for instance, here is the coldest point, and to make an easy example, as you go away from this point, the temperature rises. And they have a ruler made of a metal. The only thing all they're made of is all the same material, so that wherever it is, it expands immediately to the right length because of the high temperature. You see, like a ruler expands due to the temperature. So that wherever you put any object, a bug, a ruler, a triangle, or anything, the thing stretches itself because of expansion from the temperature. And if I move this thing down here, it gets shorter again because it's colder at the center. So that's a bug on a hot plate. I guess that's a better way to put it. A bug on a hot plate, okay? Bug on hot plate. But the plate's not uniform in temperature. Okay. Now we study geometry. These bugs are going to be students of geometry. That's a very peculiar bug. First of all, the simplest idea in geometry is a straight line, and the bug on plane A, we both know what it means. You go from here to here in a straight line. And now you turn to bug B, and he lives on a sphere, and he wants to make what corresponds to a straight line. You say, there's no such a thing. Look, you see, everything he draws has to be a curve. He can't draw a straight line. But from his own point of view, is there any way to make what would be called a straight line? And if we can say we can define a straight line in a way that doesn't require that we get off the plane in a technical way, this way we can say if he goes any other way from one place to the other, it'll go take a longer distance. The straight line is the shortest distance in his world from one point to another. And so we're going to define for bug B a straight line in a special way. If the bug is at one point here and wants to go to some other point here, if he goes like this, it's longer than if he goes in some other way, which is maybe this, I missed. It goes this way, more or less. So there is a line, which is of all lines the shortest. After some mental consideration, you will discover that this line is what you get by putting a plane right through the middle, cutting the sphere so it cuts these two points. It's called the great circle. Anyway, it's some line, okay? That's shorter than any other line, and that is straight as the bug can make it. You say, yeah, but it's still curved. But don't forget, you're one of the fellows who lives on the plane and on this surface, and you don't know anything other than that, and that's your straight line. You can't beat that. So he has a straight line. Now, with these straight lines and measurements of length, I suppose he also can lay out lengths. Oh, incidentally, in here, the straight line is also going to be the shortest distance. The bug, in going from one place to another, straight from here to here, you would think, go in a straight line. But no. It will be a shorter distance for him, believe it or not, to go in what we would call a curve. Why? Because if he will go out here a little distance with his rulers, the rulers will be longer, and the number of times the ruler has to be laid out to get from one place to the other is less than if you lay it out across here where the rulers are shorter, although the actual length is shorter. So it turns out that effectively he finds in what we would call a curve, a straight line then is defined as the shortest distance between two points. In other words, he's following Euclid. He reads page one, short, straight line, shortest distance between two points. Okay, we got that. So that's the way straight lines look for our point of view, who know that this guy's on a hot plate. And from our point of view in three dimensions, that looks like a curve. But as far as these guys who live on the surface are concerned, that's a straight line. So I think I've emphasized enough that all the rest of the analysis is always in the point of view of the creatures on the surfaces and not our own point of view. Now let's see what the geometry looks like. What you mean by geometry? For instance, they learn that if you mark off 100 units in a certain direction and make a right angle, oh, right angle is a quarter of going all the way around. You can define all those things. And go 100 units, and then go off here another 100 units after another right angle, and up here another 100 units after another right angle. Then, if you're very careful, the trained bugs are very careful, they find that those two points agree. for instance. So that's one example, is to make a square, and you see that if you make three or four right angles, it agrees. That's one of the, not necessarily another right angle, but if you make equal distances, but all ways about, it'll come out even. It'll come to the same place. And that's one property of geometry. There are other properties. If you take a triangle, lay out any triangle, three lines, three straight lines, and measure the angle in here, and in here, and in here, for instance, according to Euclid and measurements and so forth, I mean, according to the geometry in a flat space, flat plane like this, the sum of the angles of a triangle is 180 degrees. There's another theorem of geometry. Or still another theorem. If you start to take a point and draw a circle, what's a circle? A circle is made this way, that you rush off in any in many, many directions on straight lines and lay out a lot of dots that are all the same distance from the center. We have to be careful how you define these things, because we've got to be able to make the analog for the other fellows. So we measure off the same distance from the center in all directions and then make a curve that goes around there. And then we lay off our rulers and measure all the way around this circle, and also measure at the same time, incidentally, in addition, the distance out to the center, which is the common radial distance all to all the points. And if we call the radial distance r, then the circumference is 2 pi r, and 2 pi is a number which I can't remember. 2.18, it's got a lot of decimal places. At any rate, it's a very definite ratio that doesn't depend on the size of the circle or anything, and those are certain examples of geometrical properties, and I would like to investigate to what extent they're true for our bugs living on a sphere and on the plane. So the first question is whether what happens if we try to make a square. So I could come down here from the top point in a straight line, a certain distance, and then I can come over here from the top point at right angles. It's easy enough. Now when the bugs get down to here somewhere, they make that the top point, and they start off in a right angle. That's not a right angle, the right angle going something like this and coming along in a straight line, and the guy over here makes what he calls a right angle and goes along an equidistance in a straight line, and you see it just doesn't work at all. So the fellow who, the bugs here, if they would make their measurements, would discover that if they were to go off in these right angles in succession, I can't draw it on the blackboard and got it right because it's on the ball, you see, but maybe we could do that to indicate what happens, that misses. And now let's look at what happens with our friends over here. If these fellows have a similar problem, let's suppose they start at the center again, put the center here so I can draw it over again. They go off a certain distance and up a certain distance, and then they make a right angle. Actually, we pointed out the thing is slightly curved, but forget that for just a moment. It doesn't make much difference in the drawing. These lines aren't straight. But they'll be missing this way for this reason, that when you made 100 units out this way, you had all temperatures from cold to warm. But when you're measuring along here, they're on the average hotter than they are here, so that the rulers are longer. And when you laid out 100 ruler lengths, it's much further than the 100 ruler lengths along here, and the thing doesn't match anymore. Well, what I'm trying to illustrate is that by making geometrical measurements, in the world of the bugs, they can discover there's something the matter with their space. And we define curved space to be a space in which the geometry doesn't work that works in a plane. That the geometry is like what happens if you live on the surface of a sphere or on a hot plate. The geometrical rules fail. It isn't necessary to be able to lift yourself out of the plane in order to find out that the world that you live in is curved. It isn't necessary to even circumnavigate the globe in order to find out that it's a ball. You can find out it's a ball by laying out a square, and if the square is very small, the area is very small and it needs a lot of accuracy. If the square is larger, the area, of course, is larger and can be done more crudely. Let's take the case of triangle. The sum of the angles is 180 degrees. Our friend on the sphere can find triangles that are very peculiar. He can find triangles, for example, which have three right angles. You never heard of that? Yes, indeed. I'll show you a triangle with three right angles. This man works very hard to make very carefully a triangle. It starts here, and not the man. And he runs along here a certain distance, and I'm going to take him all the way down to the equator. Now, over here, in a right angle, he makes a right angle with a perfect straight line from here to here. And now you see he says, okay, I'm at this point, and I make a right angle. Well, I go right down here in a right angle and go all the way around on a straight line, which is the one of these lines, and that meets the other one also at a right angle. So there is no doubt that for him, the triangle, for instance, this triangle, has three right angles, or 270 degrees in the sum. It turns out for him that the sum of the angles of the triangle exceeds 180 degrees all the time. And in fact, the excess in this case is extra 90, that the excess is proportional to how much area the triangle has. If the triangle is very small on the sphere, it looks almost perfect, I mean, almost 180 degrees, a little bit over. As the triangle gets bigger, it gets more erroneous. And as a third example, oh, I could work the triangle on a hot plate too, but I won't. The same idea. And then third example, though, is an interesting one, and that has to do with the 2 pi for the circumference. It's the easiest to understand how to make that measurement. And we can see what would happen to our friend on the sphere. He will discover that 2 pi is less than 2 pi, as you can appreciate this way. Suppose that he lays out a radius from here and goes equal distance in all directions. Then he's going to make for a circle around, oh, well, I can't do it very well, but a circle around here. See, he goes equal distances all the way from the central point and draws a circle around here. The result of this is the circumference. He can measure that, and this is the radius, and he measures that. Now, we are wise in three dimensions, and we know how to calculate that because we look at the sphere from the side, and he's at the top, and he went around this way, and now he's got a circle. You see, it goes around the sphere so. And you know that the correct radius for that circle, in other words, the radius which is the white one so that the circumference is 2 pi times that radius, is this distance, whereas our four bug man is measuring this distance, which is longer. So he would find that that his measurement of the radius exceeds the theoretical radius determined from the circumference. In other words, suppose he measured the circumference and divided by 2 pi, and we call that the predicted radius. That predicted radius is really this distance then, huh? Boy, now he actually goes to the trouble of measuring the radius, and to his horror, if he's read Euclid, he discovers that his predicted radius, that his actual measured radius exceeds the predicted radius by some excess. So there can be, we can call that excess radius effect of a circle. Let me show you the simple example here with the hot plate, that there will be a similar phenomenon, exactly a similar phenomenon. I don't know why I drew the axes. There's the cold point of the plate. He measures out here a certain distance by laying out his rulers, which we watch as he does it, and we see his rulers get very long out there and very short in there. And then he goes around a curve, which is equal distance from the center all the time, and he measures with his long ruler, you see, because it's all hot out there. The ruler's hot all the time, and it's long. And when he counts how many times he has to put the ruler in, why doesn't he measure it some other way? What other way is there but to lay it out and then measure it with a ruler? Well, that's the only way he knows. So he measures it with a ruler around. And the number of times that the ruler fits in the circumference is surely not correct for the number of times it runs along the radius, because, you see, he has too many of them from our point of view. In the inside, he has an excess apparent radius. That is to say, he would get 2 pi if the ruler didn't change its length as it went in. In other words, if it didn't shrink. Since it does shrink, there are more lengths in the longer radius than there ought to be. And he measures an apparent excess radius. Now, I then will define a curved space as a space in which these types of geometrical errors occur. That the sum of the angles begins to exceed, for example, 180 degrees, 2 pi, a circle of a given circumference divided by 2 pi for a predicted radius turns out to have an actual radius which exceeds that. And so squares don't fit, and so on, as an example of a curved space. Now, I have here, in fact, two examples of curved space, which is rather interesting, which is that he actually lives on a sphere, and the other is he's on a hot plate with a ruler. It is possible to adjust the temperature as a function of distance in this problem so that everything he measures is exactly the same as what he measures. It's rather amusing. You can make this guy get all the answers exactly the same as the answers on the ball. And I'll tell you what the answer is for those who like geometry and geometrical problems. If you assume that the length of the rulers, or the temperature, the length of the rulers, goes in proportion to 1 plus some constant times the square of the distance away from the origin, then you'll find that the geometry of that hot plate is exactly the same in all details as the geometry of a sphere. I must insist, of course, that it isn't the only possibilities in the world being a sphere. It could be it's more like a pear, that has got a sharper curvature in one place and a weaker curvature in the other place, so that the excesses in triangles are more severe when you make the little triangles in one part of your world than if you make them in another part. In other words, the curvature can vary from place to place. That's a generalization of the idea, a more complicated thing. I've just taken the simplest example of a sphere. I might also point out that the answer can come out backwards. You could find out, for example, that all triangles, when they're made too large, have less than 180 degrees. That sounds like it's impossible, but it isn't at all. First of all, I could have my ruler game with the temperature falling as I went out, naturally, and everything would be reversed. But I can even do it geometrically by living on a surface. But it's not a sphere. It's the inside of a saddle. Imagine a saddle, see, like here. So, now draw a radius from the center of the saddle out. Now look at the circumference. Do you see how it has to go up and down and up and down as it goes around the saddle? Sort of scallopy effect, which is much longer than it is for the radius. Well, for the sphere, the circumference was shorter than it was for the radius. So you can have the excess negative or positive for different kinds. Spheres and so on are called surfaces of positive curvature. The others are called surfaces of negative curvature. In general, a two-dimensional world will have a curvature which varies from place to place and may be positive in some places and negative in other places and so forth. So by a curved space, I mean one in which when we do these geometrical things like this, they behave like that, and that this curvature may in fact vary from place to place. May I also point out that from this definition of curvature, surprisingly enough, a cylinder or a cone, let's take a cylinder, is not curved in this definition. If a bug lived on a cylinder, I have just discovered a cylinder. If a bug lived on a cylinder, this is actually a cone, but it'll work the same way. Then if you make any triangles and so forth, I can show them that they will give the same answers as if you live on a plane. There's dirt in this thing, so you don't look at it. But because imagine that all these lines and so on are drawn on here, and then the thing is unrolled. You see that a cylinder or a cone can be unrolled onto a plane. And therefore, all the geometrical figures can be made to correspond exactly to the way they are on a plane. So there's no way for a bug living on a cylinder, if he doesn't go all the way around, but just makes local measurements, to discover that it's curved. And technically, in that sense, we consider that not a curved surface. There's a special definition of curved surface. It's what we more correctly call intrinsic curvature, a curvature which can be measured by living only on the thing in a local region. But that's all technical machine business about the meaning of words. You can use words different ways, but this is the way that Einstein meant to use it when he said that the space is curved. Done with two dimensions, done with the definition of curved space. Now we must go onward to three dimensions. Say, okay, we live in three-dimensional space. We're going to consider the idea that the three-dimensional space is curved. Say, yeah, but how can you imagine it bent in any direction like you did with the sphere? Well, you can't imagine it bent in any direction because your imagination is no good. Well, maybe it's good. I think it's very useful. People always complain that human imagination isn't good enough. I think it's very good that it doesn't get too free of the real world. It has enough trouble. Many people have enough trouble in trying to understand what's true, much less invent more and more wild things. But anyhow, we can define the curvature by the same idea without getting out of our three-dimensional world. You see, all this exercise was simply to get a definition of curvature which didn't require that you look from the outside. Or one other thing, and here I look from the outside in a certain sense. If one day in this bug world someone would come along with an Invar ruler, that is, a ruler which did not contract because of the temperature, And all of a sudden, they would discover the whole thing, the whole secret that they live, you know, they... Otherwise, they can't tell whether they live this way or they got nice rulers on a sphere. They can't tell. There's no way to tell. If it's absolutely universal that every device whatsoever shrinks the same way. So I'm going to assume with these hot plates cases and so on that it's completely universal. It doesn't. You can't find all of a sudden a new substance which shrinks in a different proportion. Then you have all kinds of complications, but you have it universal. Well, we can determine whether our world is now curved or not in an analogous way to the gentleman who are either on the sphere or the hot plate. We can't distinguish those two cases, but we certainly can distinguish those cases from the flat space, the plane. Answer, how? Well, it's easy. We would be the same thing. Suppose we lay out a triangle and measure the angles, or we make a great big circle and measure the circumference and the radius. It's perfectly similar. We lay out squares and so forth, or make cubes and things, and we ask whether the laws of geometry work. In fact, then it is in principle understandable what is meant by the curved space. It means, for instance, that if I laid out a triangle, a big triangle, and measured the sum of the angles, it might exceed 180 degrees. You'll notice that in three dimensions, the situation is much more complicated than in two. In two dimensions, at any one place, there's a certain amount of curvature. But in three dimensions, there's a whole lot of components, because even if I laid out a triangle here, I might get a different answer than if I put the triangle this way. Or in other words, take an example of a circle for a standard case. You draw a circle and measure the radius, and it doesn't check. There's an excess radius. Now draw the circle that way. Well, there's no need that the excess be exactly the same. In fact, there might be a defect in the other direction. Or then put the circle this way, and so on. So that the curvature has many numbers to define it in a three-dimensional space. It's more complicated. There are a lot of components of curvature. You say, I got a better idea. Never mind all those components. Suppose that you do the following. You make a sphere in three dimensions. You construct a whole lot of points that are all the same distance from a given point in space. It's impossible to draw a sphere on a blackboard. You know that? It always looks like a circle. Anyhow, you got this sphere. Here's a sphere. And you measure the surface area by laying out distances on the surface of the sphere and measuring the area. And according to the Euclid, the area is supposed to be 4 pi times the square of the radius. What we're going to do is we measure the area, then we take the area divided by 4 pi, which is supposed to be the square of the radius, and take the square root, and we might call this the predicted radius. Then we could also measure the radius toward the center directly by walking, digging a hole in it and going down toward the center and measure directly the radius. And that we would call the measured radius. And the measured radius minus the predicted radius we could call a radius excess, you see. And that would be a measure of the curvature, for instance. And that would be perfectly satisfactory. You say, but that has a great advantage, that it doesn't depend upon how you hold the triangle. It has the advantage and disadvantage. It's a mean value of the other curvatures, but it doesn't alone characterize the space. If you only knew this number, you couldn't predict all the geometry of the space because you couldn't tell what would happen with a circle this way and this way and this way. In other words, if you do make a sphere, you get some kind of an averaging effect over the curvatures, which, as a matter of fact, is called the mean curvature of the three-dimensional world, this particular one. But it's an average, and it doesn't solve the problem of completely defining the geometry. The complete definition requires lots of numbers. Of course, the mathematicians know how to write all these numbers. I'm explaining the idea of the thing, and you can read in mathematics books when you want someday how to write all this in a high-class and elegant form. But it's first a good idea to know what it is you're trying to write about. All right, that's the definition of curved space. I'm done with that. That's the definition. That explains the idea. Now, the only question is it true? I mean, is space curved? Once we have enough imagination to realize the possibility that it's curved, naturally, the human mind gets curious about the question as to whether or no the real world is curved. And people have made geometrical measurements to find out and haven't found any deviations as far as they can measure directly. On the other hand, by arguments about gravitation and so forth, Einstein discovered, yes, that the space is curved. And I'd like to tell you how curved and what Einstein's law is. Einstein said, found out, and I'll tell you a little bit of how he found out, that the space is curved where in the location that matter is the source of the curvature. The places where matter is where the space is curved. The matter is the source of the curvature. It's also the source of gravitation, and gravity is related to the curvature, but that comes later in the lecture. Anyway, where matter is, the space is curved. And the rule that he gave for the curvature, which is called the law of gravitation, of the field, the curvature produced by matter, is given by the following law. Wherever there's matter, which we suppose is distributed in space, we take small enough volume so we can have, we take a small volume of matter, which we suppose small enough that the density of the material, the matter inside, is uniform, just to make it easy, then the following is true. That this excess radius that I just defined over here for a ball containing matter at a uniform density is the gravity constant divided by 3 times the speed of light squared times the mass that's contained inside the sphere. That's Einstein's law that gives the curvature of the world as a function of the matter in it. The rule is the following. Draw a sphere around any little element of material. Well, let's say a big element. Suppose we take the Earth as an example and forget that the density varies from point to point. Otherwise, you have to do integrals and so forth. But take a uniform density Earth. Then if we measure the surface of the Earth very carefully with careful measurements and then dug a hole and measured the radius of the Earth, well, we calculate from the surface what radius we think it is from 4 pi r squared, and then measure the actual radius. The actual radius will exceed the radius measured by predicted indirectly by the constant of gravity over 3 times the speed of light squared times the total mass of the Earth. Incidentally, this number here is 2 times 10 to the minus 29 centimeters per gram. So for each gram of material, you're off by 10 to the minus 29 centimeters. In the excess radius, and it turns out that for the Earth, 2.4 actually, that for the Earth, the radius would turn out if we could dig the hole, and it's a little improvement over the molehole. You have to go all the way down to the dead center. If you'd measure this, you would find that the Earth was 2 millimeters more in radius than it should be for the surface. And that the Sun, in the same manner, figure it out, is a half a kilometer too long. That's a little bit more. 500 yards, you got a better chance. But of course, the Sun is so big, you got a better chance for error in digging your hole from the center. I would like to remark that outside of the Earth, this law would say that the curvature, average curvature, is zero, but it doesn't say that the curvature in certain planes is zero. So that there's a certain law that relates to curvatures in different directions. So that the moment you tell me the average curvature everywhere, I can figure out what the real details of curvature are everywhere. In the space outside the Earth, if you draw circles one way, you get an excess. If you draw circles another way, you get a defect. So for a sphere, it averages to zero because there's no mass inside. But nevertheless, there are curvature effects outside of the Earth, and that's the way the Earth influences things outside of it in the form of gravitation. So there are curvatures, but no mean curvature where there's no mass. All right. Now, that explains that wherever there's pieces of matter, there are little nubbins. It's like a pimples. You have a plane with pimples, with bumps of curvature. Not a sphere, but a plane. This flat space would be, if it were bug world, it would be a flat plane, and every place where there's matter, there would be some kind of little pimples or hills and so forth. The other question that's interesting is the question of what the overall properties of the whole space are. Aside from the pimples, which we've just discussed, which are produced by the matter like the Earth and the Sun, we'd like to know whether the whole space is curved all the way around or not. And this Depends on how many pimples there are and where they are and so forth, whether the accumulated effect of all the pimples is to make a ball or what. And the only thing that you can get the answer to that from today is by observations at large distances of the galaxies and so forth, by seeing when you look at great distances whether there are too many of them than you would expect, etc. I don't have time to go into in detail to that. I would just say that although there has been of tremendous interest because of curiosity and the importance of such questions about what the great geometry of the universe is, and therefore anybody who has the Palomar telescope and is responsible for measuring these things insists on putting out some kind of a statement as to which way the world is curved because of the importance and so forth, it is nevertheless true that the astronomical measurements are completely inconclusive, and we haven't got the slightest idea whether the whole universe is flat on the average or crowned on the average or open or closed or anything at the present time. All debates and whatnot to the subject notwithstanding, the reason there are so many debates is that the measurements are completely inconclusive. Done. Next, we talked about the curvature of space and time when we mentioned Einstein's idea, the curvature of space-time, and we now have to talk a little bit about gravity and time and so on. That the measurements of space and the measurements of time are interrelated, you all know from your knowledge of the special theory of relativity, and it would be kind of crazy, impossibly crazy, to have the space one way without getting the time involved in the same thing. For example, you know that something like the hot rulers and so on, the rate at which time is measured depends on various things, well, only one thing that you know of, and that is the speed at which you move. I won't go over it in spite of the fact that there are guests, because both the freshmen and sophomore by this time know that in a spaceship, if you have a guy in a spaceship and he's riding past you, that from the point of view of somebody on the ground, things seem to go slower in a spaceship. They don't seem any different to the man in the spaceship. Everything in his world goes slower, and he thinks slower, and he talks slower, and the guy who's listening to him thinks slower, so it all seems the same to them. But from the outside, you can see that when he lights a cigar, it takes him a long time, put a flame, and so on. Now, I just remark on this important, interesting point. Suppose a man stands here, and if another man goes away in a spaceship and goes around for a while and comes back, and let's say returns in 100 seconds flat, exactly, as measured by the man here on the ground with his clock, then the clock, if the fella carried a wristwatch in the spaceship, when he came back, his wristwatch might say 95 seconds. Well, he was moving pretty fast to do that. There's a big effect. But it would be less because that's because of what I just said, that things go slow in a spaceship. This I bring out for an interesting reason, that if you want to get if you want to have a watch you start at a given moment at a given signal and you end at a given signal at the same place, how shall you move so your watch gives the longest possible reading? The answer is to stand still. If you move at all, the watch will read less. It's an interesting principle, which I'd like to continue. If you go from one place to another, if you leave here at a certain signal and have to arrive here at a certain signal, then you might think one way you might go is this, another way you might go is a uniform speed neatly from one point to the other in a straight line, and so on. The question is, for which path will your clock, when you get here, read the latest? And the answer is, the longest time, from your point of view, is when you go in a uniform speed in a straight line. Reason, all the extra motions and high speeds that are in quiet make the clock go slower. Therefore, one way to say what a straight line is, which has changed from a straight line in space-time becomes the idea of a uniform motion a motion from one place to the other at a uniform speed. That's the analog of a straight line in space-time, and the geometrical definition is, it's such, not that the distance is shortest, because there are certain funny signs in the laws of relativity, but that the time is longest. the straight line motion, or the analog of it, that is the uniform velocity motion in a straight line, is that motion such that carrying a watch from the initial condition to the final condition reads as late as possible. So you have a definition of the analog of a straight line for space-time. Now I would like to discuss the laws of gravitation. Einstein, trying to get the laws of gravitation to fit with his relativity theory, had to discuss many items, and just trying to generate a theory of gravitation that would fit with the relativity theory that he had developed before, was struggling along until he latched onto one important principle which guided him in getting the correct law. That principle is that idea that when a thing is falling freely, everything inside, like a satellite is falling freely, everything inside seems weightless. And that principle, stated with great precision, is what's called Einstein's principle of equivalence and was the guiding principle. The idea that the mass of a thing, that all objects fall exactly with the same acceleration no matter what their mass. If I have a spaceship and it's falling, but inside the spaceship there's a ball, and the ball is falling, then the fall laws are the same for the ball and for the spaceship, and so the spaceship, the ball stays in the middle of the spaceship. It doesn't fall relative to the spaceship. Now, this can be stated in another way, which is the following. Suppose that I'm in an elevator, in empty world. That's the better as a rocket ship. We can use rocket ships. They used to use elevators in Einstein's day, but nowadays we can use rocket ships. We have a rocket ship which is accelerating upward. That is, it's not just moving upward, but the gases are running out the rear end and it's going accelerating upward. I shouldn't say upward. It's an empty space. It's millions of miles from anybody, so it's accelerating in that direction. There's no gravity. And I compare that to a situation in a corresponding spaceship which is sitting on the Earth's surface. And we'll suppose that the acceleration happens to be exactly one, what they call 1G. Then, first of all, if there was a man standing here inside and he let go of a ball, it'll fall to the ground. What? Oh, sure. Well, your ball is there and the spaceship moves up and it leaves the ball behind. I mean, until it hits the floor, yeah? The ball is left there and the spaceship is accelerating, so it hits. The floor hits the ball. From the point of view of the man, the ball hits the floor. Same situation in here. All you fellows, for all we know, we're all on a spaceship, see, accelerating. And the reason that you feel the pressure on the seat of your pants is because you're being accelerated upward. In order to get accelerated upward, if I hold this up, you see, it proves the acceleration. If I let go of it, the table comes up and hits it. So we're all accelerating upward. Now, Einstein's principle was this, that there should be no way to distinguish, at least at one point, it's a technical improvement. Let me leave out the technical remark for a moment. There's no way to distinguish experimentally this condition of accelerating from the gravitation. None at all is the principle. Now, before I go, I want to say that that's only true for one point in the spaceship, because in fact, the Earth is round and the gravity is in different directions and is a little bit stronger at the bottom than at the top. And so although I can get the balance to go exactly to zero, say for this special point, there'll be a little bit of force here, a little bit of force here, a little bit in and so on. So those are like tidal forces. The principle of equivalence only says that this is true at one point. I want to make it correct. But to keep it from being, without worrying about the technical difficulties of the fact that there may be angles involved and you can only get it to cancel out at one point, let's go back to the idea. Then let's say a uniform gravity, where you don't worry about the angles and the irregularities as a function of distance, is completely imitated by acceleration in every respect. Everything that happens in this will happen here. That's a great principle, because now we can tell what's going to happen there by figuring out what happens here. Now, I give an interesting example of something that happens in here, which you wouldn't have expected and which you would almost deny could possibly happen here. And that's the following. I have put a standard clock up here at the top, which ticks at a definite rate. One, two, three, four, tick-tock, tick-tock. And I have another standard clock down here with which to compare it. Now, I look at this clock, and I compare it to this, and I'll discover that this clock seems to run fast. It's easy to see. Why? I mean, don't forget the thing is accelerating. So here's the picture in succession. Suppose that to make the clock very easy, it simply lets out a light flash. Pip, 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 pip. It lets out light flashes every second. Now I draw a picture of the elevator 1 second later. And here's the elevator 1 second later. So here a light pip came, and is being coming out. I'm drawing this way because it takes some time for the light to get here. So as it comes down, the elevator is moving up. Now, I draw a picture of the elevator at the next second. You say, you're cheating. You made it go further. Yes, I'm not cheating. It's accelerating, isn't it? It's moving faster. And then in the next second, it's going still faster. So it's way up here. Now, let's try to see how these signals will appear to approach the ground. There's nothing mysterious about it. You'll see that each time, the signal has a shorter distance to go. And therefore, although they emit it every second, since this one takes a long time, less time, they hit here with a smaller interval between them. Yes, because this one gets here quicker than this one got here, but they started a second apart, and therefore this comes more rapidly after this than it would have been before. So therefore, if you look at the clock with its pips, you'll see them more rapidly coming at the ground. Likewise, in reverse, the light from the bottom will approach the top end, and each time has to go further in an increasing sequence, and the times seem to be slower. So a man looking at the top, watching somebody up there, would see the clocks go fast, while a guy looking down the other way will see them go slowly. That's all right. There's nothing the matter with that. But this means that if every phenomenon inside the elevator is the same as it is in the gravity, this means that a clock set at the top of the room, you make two standing clocks and put one at the top of the room and watch it, then it'll go faster. You say, yeah, but it's wrong. The time is the same. The distance is the same all the time. I know. But if you insist on the principle that Einstein insisted on, that you shouldn't be able to tell whether you're accelerating or you're in a gravity field, you've got to get the same phenomena. And he simply went ahead blindly, but bravely and correctly, courageously, but blindly, to propose that the thing would actually look like that. And now what was happening is that the time is different up here and then in here. That if you put an object here, it runs at a different rate. Even a standard clock appears to go slowly here when it goes fast here. This is the analog of our hot ruler that we were talking about. That we take the ruler to some other place and it just gets longer. We can't beat the game. And we can't beat the game here. If you carry a clock up here, in this part of the world, time goes slower. That's all. Everything goes slower. Everything? Why everything? Suppose, how do you know human beings go slow or something like that? Or you put two different kinds of clocks here. If they don't both look the same, well, they would look the same in this case. They look the same in that case. Anyway, they got to look the same. Or else you could find out something was the matter. Never mind. All things have to go the same. I can't get a quick argument on it. Otherwise, you would be able to see the difference between this case and this case. Now, there's a very peculiar idea that time varies, the rate of time or clocks or things varies from place to place. It's a difficult idea, but it's the idea that Einstein used, and it's one which turns out to be correct, believe it or not. In this thing, we can figure out that the apparent rate of the clock which is received, the apparent rate that we receive it, is not the same as the rate and in which it's emitted, or the standard rate of emission, as we just mentioned, but differs. And if you figure it out in here, you see it comes out wider by 1 minus g, the acceleration, times h over c. There are several ways you can sit down because of shortage of time. It's an interesting moment, that shortage of time. Because of shortage of time, I won't explain the detail of it, but the idea is, you can figure it out yourself by just counting how far the thing goes and how much decrease in time there is between the things and get this formula out. A very easy way to get the formula is to use the Doppler effect and to notice the following, that the receiver of the light is always moving faster than the emitter. It's always moving toward the emitter. When the emitter was moving, it's moving at a low speed. When it's received, the receiver is moving at a fast speed. And the receiver is always moving toward the emitter by a velocity, which is the velocity which has been accumulated during the acceleration, during the time, h over c, that the light has gone from the top to the bottom. So this is the Doppler effect that corrects this formula. This is the Doppler effect for light from the top to the bottom. For those who like mathematics, you can also show that, well, it's good enough. Now, I would like to, since this is such an important idea, I would like to demonstrate it just still another way, that it's true by using other laws of physics, and that's interesting. We can prove it by the conservation of energy. Supposing that gravity acts on the total mass, on the total energy content of a thing, and not just on the rest mass, and there are lots of experiments that demonstrate that, we can prove it by the conservation of energy. Suppose that I have an atom, which can be, or a nucleus or something, which can be in a low energy state, EO, and in a higher energy level, E1. And then it can emit a light, a photon, or a gamma ray or something, going from the excited state to the lower state, and the frequency of the gamma ray is related to the energy difference by this formula. That's standard stuff. Now, suppose that we start with a system in energy E1, so that its mass, as you know, is E1 over C squared. Then we carry that thing up to the top of the room. I carry this excited atom up, and I do a certain amount of work. Because the mass corresponds to E1 over C squared, the work is the mass times the gravity constant times the height. That's the work done in carrying it up. Now when it's up here in E1, I let it emit its photon, and so it turns to E0. Now I'm carrying it down again after it's emitted the photon. When I'm carrying it down, because it's emitted some energy and is not as heavy as it was before, the work I do is less. So in order, I would get perpetual motion if it weren't for the fact that the energy that the photon gives me down here is more. You see, or negative perpetual motion anyway. The idea is you do more work in carrying it up than you get back carrying it down, and to make the conservation of energy work out, that extra work appears in the energy of the photon. Another way to put it is that the energy of a mass up here is the gravitational energy plus its rest energy. Well, at any rate, if you add this extra work to the work of the to the work that you would ordinarily get from the photon, then you get GH over C times the difference of the work going up and down, and you see that the frequency observed must be different than the frequency that you would get if you didn't carry it to the ceiling by the numerical factor 1 plus GH over C. This is a very small numerical factor, and experiments have been made to demonstrate the truth of it. Now I'd like to discuss the idea of this thing in terms of the idea of curved space-time. I've already explained that if the time goes at different rates in different places, that it's very much like curved space. Suppose I lay out a ruler 100 feet, let's say, vertically. This is vertically, 100 feet. And then I wait. I'm plotting in space-time, a very peculiar thing, but those in the physics course have seen plots in space-time before. And you measure time up this way, 2 minutes or 10 minutes. Now, if you measure time up this way, 10 minutes, because the clock goes slower here, this is going to be later than this. And if I look at all the points that are simultaneous, 100 feet apart here, it won't fit. The square doesn't fit. The square in space and time won't fit anymore. That is, if I wait at 2 points, 10 minutes, these 2 points are no longer, start simultaneous, they don't end simultaneous after 10 minutes as measured by each guy. So the squares don't fit, and that's what we mean by the space-time is curved. I would like to give you a little puzzle. I'll give you the answer also, but it's an interesting puzzle. Here's the Earth's surface. If I carry a clock to the high distances and let it run, it runs, you remember, faster. It appears to run faster at high distances. It appears faster from the guy on the ground. So I carry it up to a height and then carry it down. Then the clock that arrives here will arrive with a later time. In other words, suppose I stand here and I carry it to a great height, and then I bring it down, and it comes back 100 seconds later as measured by the guy on the ground. Then the wristwatch, which is carried by the man here, will read not 100, but maybe 107 seconds, because his clock goes faster from the height. Now, my game is the following: to make this excess time as maximal as possible, to make it as great as possible. The time read on the wristwatch should be as large as it possibly can. This is going to be our straight line. The same idea is here, that the clock should read as much as possible. I say it's very easy. You carry it as high as you can, because the higher you go, the better the effect. And you forgot something. You've only got 100 seconds to do it. If you try to go too high, you've got to go very fast. And don't forget something, that when you go fast, there's a shift in the time, which goes as 1 minus v squared over c squared square root, or 1 minus v squared over 2c squared approximately. That's this effect here, which tends to make the thing smaller if you move. So we have a game, you see. The problem is, if we just stand there, we get 100. If we can get a little bit of height, we're OK. So if we go slowly enough, then this isn't going to cause us any trouble, and we can get some height and come back, so we can get a little bit bigger than 100, surely. Well, let's try to get a little bit more height. Then we have to go a little bit too fast, and we can adjust and find a program. We can calculate a special program of motion, how high to go, at what speed, and how to come down in just exactly the right way, so that going up and coming down is speeding and everything is just right, so you arrive back at 100 seconds, and so that the wristwatch that you read reads as maximal number that it can, the biggest possible number. If you go any higher, it's got to go too fast, and this overtakes you. If you don't go this high, then you don't get the effect of the gravity X, and you don't get as big a number. What is the correct program for going up and coming down? Answer: find out how fast you'd have to shoot a bullet up so that when it fell back to Earth, it would take exactly 100 seconds. And this motion, the rising fast and then slowing down and coming down and speeding up, is exactly the right motion to make the time the maximum according to the wristwatch. Another example. Suppose they have the same game, but we have two points, A and B, both on the Earth's surface, for example, are separated from one another. Now we play the same game that we did over here to find what we call the straight line. To find this, that we start here at a certain signal, and we have to arrive here at another signal, which we'll say is 100 seconds later. And I want to go along from one place to the other somehow. Now, you say, well, I found out over there the thing to do is to uniformly coast along here at a uniform speed to arrive here at 100 seconds, and I'll be behind somewhat, but not as much as if I went any other thing, because I have to go too fast. Ah, but wait. Wouldn't it be a little bit better to curve up a little bit like this and come down? Because at least during part of the time, you're higher up and your clock goes faster? Yes, it is. And so if you'll solve the mathematical problem of adjusting the curve and the motion so that the exact way that you move is that the time is the maximum that it can be, then lo, you find that's exactly the way something moves when let free. That's exactly the way, and the parabola and the velocities and everything are exactly right for the free motion of an object in space according to the law of gravitation. Therefore, the law of gravitation, in this case, can be stated by saying that the object always moves from one place to the other so that the clock carried on it gives a longer time than any other clock could. For the sophomores only, I would like to write the equation for this. This formula from this argument here, you'll see, can be generalized for a much more complicated situation. This is obviously there's a c square here. This is obviously the gravitational potential over c square, and that the correction for time is not 1 over gh over c square, but is in general 1 plus the gravitational potential over c square. So the excess in time that we get per second is the gravitational potential times the time. The defect in time is the velocity squared over twice the speed of light. times time. So what we have to do is make this integral as maximum integral. If I multiply this integral by minus m times 2 times c squared, just to make another formula, then, just mc squared, then this formula becomes mv squared over 2 minus m phi times dt, which is the kinetic energy minus the potential energy of the thing. Now, we had discussed what we call the principle of least action, which was that the integral on the real motion of the kinetic energy take away the potential energy is always a minimum. So this works not only for the Earth's surface, but even when we take into account the fact that the gravity is in different directions around the Earth, the satellites going in their elliptic orbits and so on are so constructed moving that Gordon Cooper's wristwatch reads later than it for going from one place to another on the orbit if it's not too far. I'll explain that in a minute. Or that's like going all the way around the Earth. You can sometimes make a shortcut, but never mind that. It reads as late as possible compared to any nearby path or any other way that the satellite will move. And so the law of gravitation can be stated in that remarkable way, which we translate into the ideas of geometry by saying that the particles always take the shortest or the longest time or the shortest distance in the space-time. That's the law of gravitation. The great advantage of it is that it doesn't depend upon any way, any coordinates or any other way of defining the situations. I have given you two laws for gravity. One, how the time and space and the geometry changes when matter is present. And that was given by the rule that the curvature when there's matter is corrected this way. Now, I give you another rule which says that the world, that objects move if there's no other forces, on free forces of gravity only, in such a way that they make the maximum the time, what's called the proper time, the time they read as they ride along. These, then, are the two laws that correspond in other branches of physics, such as electricity, to the following two laws. The laws which give the electric fields that are produced by the charges, this tells the character of the space which is produced by the matter. And the other which says, given the electric fields, what are the forces on a particle? The Q times electric field plus V cross the magnetic field. Those tell how a particle moves in a magnetic field, and that's given by my second remark here, that the matter moves in such a way that the proper time is a maximum. And then that's the way Einstein's theory of gravitation appears in much more complicated mathematical form than the one that I've described here. I would like to explain one more feature that, as you can fully appreciate, I've only done this approximately in first approximation. For weak corrections, you must do it much more elegantly and completely. That furthermore, as I've explained, the time rule, the time lengths vary from place to place. That's easy, that we talked about. It is also true that ruler lengths change from place to place. It's impossible with space and time so intimately mixed to have something happen to time that isn't in some way reflected in space, because even to take the simplest example, if I'm riding past the Earth, the time from one man's point of view is partly my space, and so there must be also changes in space. So it's the entire space-time which is distorted, and it's more complicated. And as a matter of fact, strangely, this rule that I gave here is enough to determine completely all the laws of gravitation. Provided it's understood that this rule about the curvature of space applies not only from one man's point of view, but is true for everybody. That is, somebody riding by this mass of material sees a different mass content because of the kinetic energy he sees of the thing moving past him and so on, and he also has to get this apparent curvature. So that space-time will be so balanced that everybody, no matter how they move, will all see that if they draw a sphere, the excess radius, as defined over there, is g over 3c squared times the total mass, or g over 3 times the total energy content inside the sphere. That this should be true in any system, no matter how it's moving, is the great law, one of the equations of gravitation, Einstein's field equation, so-called, and the equation that things must move so that the proper time is a maximum is another great equation, which is called Einstein's equation of motion. I then would summarize everything that I said in this way. that time and distance rates, as a matter of fact, distance rates in different directions, I forgot that, the ruler I had here stretched, it's more complicated in general. The ruler I had here was the same length this way as that way. When I put it this way, it stretched the same amount as that. Well, you're going to have more complicated in different directions. It could stretch different amounts and so on, so it's more general. The time and distance rates depend upon the place that you're located and the time. That is equivalent to the statement that space-time is curved. That's the meaning of it. Second, that the average area of a sphere can define a predicted radius, but that the actual measured radius will have an excess, which is the constant of gravity over 3 times the total energy contained inside the sphere, or no, the mass contained inside the sphere over c squared. And that this must be true no matter who's looking at it or how it's moving and so forth. And in those two laws, I've given you the formulation of the laws of gravitation to represent them in mathematical form, to compare them to electricity, to compare them to Newton's laws and so on. Of course, it's quite difficult, but this is the way the physical law of gravity looks today. Thank you very much. Thank you.
The other day in EY1, they were telling us about these various measurements that the astronomers had made. Some value, they said, if it was a certain value, you had a certain curve of space. And they said, most recently, they figured out somewhere between open and closed.
Well, yeah, it means they don't know. It's inconclusive. If you read it carefully, you'll find what astronomers have a habit of pointing out that there are certain things that they cannot estimate. And so for a while, they'll say there's no such effect. They're not like physicists who, when they give the data, at the same moment tell you what they left out. They leave it out in the paper, and then they all agree that it's left out, but they forget to mention it. Example. One of the methods of measuring the distance, to compare it to the redshift, which to make the distance by the redshift and to see how many nebulae there are, or one way to measure this is how bright the nebulae are at a distance. But in order to do that, it depends on the assumption, since we're looking at nebulae which are much older than the present time, we have to know how bright old nebulae were. Now, we don't know the theory, the evolution of nebulae, how the stars develop and how things go with time. So when we look at nebulae which are several billion years old, I mean, we look 7 billion years away or 100 millions of years away, we're looking at things that were there earlier that haven't lived as long as ours, assuming one picture of the universe that everything exploded. Then we don't know how bright such nebulae should be on the average. So if they, for instance, all looked extra bright, that could be one thing. They could be closer than we think. Or it could be simply that young nebulae are brighter than old nebulae for mechanical reasons. We don't know the history of it. So in the paper on the subject, they will be very careful to mention that we do not know whether the absolute brightness of nebulae in the past is the same as it is at the present. We will assume they are the same, so we will proceed with the analysis. Then they can come out with a definite answer, but it doesn't really mean whether the space is curved or not. It's a combination of whether the space is curved and whether the nebulae in the past are brighter or not because of the history of the development and so on. So you have to be very careful with astronomical conclusion, astronomers' conclusions. There are all these difficulties. Now, you say, but this one I looked at wasn't measuring the bright, it was measuring how many nebulae they are per unit volume. But the same paper who measures that will point out that in order to say whether a nebulum is there or not depends on how bright it is, because it depends on whether it registers on a photograph. So what they're really telling is how many are between this brightness and that brightness in a certain volume. Well, that depends on whether they brightened up or not, you see. So that also depends upon the history of the nebulae and so forth. All measurements that have been made on this stuff are completely confounded by the problems that old nebulae might not look like new nebulae, and it's exaggerated the precision of the conclusions. So we don't know, in my opinion. I'm very strong about this because they always want to make a statement because of its importance and interest, but there's no way to really make it today.
Are there any
What do you mean by, it depends on how accurate you want the solution. A spherically symmetrical object can get an exact solution. If you're an exactist, you can't get a many, there are a few others, I don't know, some cylindrical things or something. But if you're willing to do something in a series of approximations, like if we do in electricity and we do in any other branch of physics, except in general relativity, where some big features made of the fact that you can't do it exactly, but in any other field, most of the problems can't be solved exactly, and we solve them in a sequence of approximations. Yes, then we can get accurate, more and more accurate, until it's way beyond anything that you would want to measure. I forgot to mention an important feature that's very interesting in gravity. The gravity equations are like electrodynamic equations in many respects. In one respect, they differ, and that is that in electricity, the principle of superposition works. In gravity, it doesn't work. And the reason it doesn't work is really quite easy to understand. Energy is a source of gravitation, but gravitation has energy. So gravity is a source of gravity to an extent, you see. So that as the objects move around each other, the energy in the gravity field is changing, and that is a new source of gravity. So gravity affects itself, and that's equivalent to the statement that the things are not linear.
There is that.
And it's complicated, but it can be done. There's an analog, yes, there is. However, it's very, very weak and very hard to detect directly. For the reason is this. You know, I think you're in the sophomore class, huh? No. Oh, I see. Well, in electricity, we discussed magnetism is very obvious. And we discussed why it's obvious. And the answer is that electricity is enormously powerful, but it canceled the plus and minus. It can't, well, no, not compared to gravity, but just electrical forces are very powerful. If I would just take 1% of the charges off of this and 1% off of me, the force between us would be more than the attraction of the Earth for the Moon. It's tremendous force.
Yeah.
And it's electrical, but it's all balanced, the plus and minus exactly balanced. Now, when things begin to move, there's slight changes due to relativity. The electrical force is changed by order of v² over c². So when you have moving electrons and wires, there's a little bit of residual force.
Yeah.
That's magnetism. Now, in gravity, all the force is already plus. When the things move, the corrections are only v² over c², but it's still plus, and it's only a small correction to what's already there. So there is gravity magnetism, but because the main gravity isn't canceled out, it's merely another way of saying there are slight corrections to gravity due to motion. Yes, sir.
About carrying a clock up,
yeah,
and then coming back down. Well, this clock, if it's gonna.
I didn't carry a clock up. I carried an atom up.
Oh, sure. Well, if you pull the picture down, but for example, when you had
this one,
a clock on the, just a clock on the ground, the wristwatch going up and coming back.
Oh, that one, yes.
Okay,
yeah.
Well,
right.
That wristwatch is gonna have to accelerate too. If it's gonna get back, it's going to have to.
Yes.
So if you wanted to forget about gravity and just pretend that if the whole thing was accelerating, you'd have to add some acceleration for the wristwatch.
Yes. Yes.
Well.
Yes. Well, it depends on how to. You see, the answer to this question is very. The answer to why it is that it goes up and comes down in exactly the right law of motion is really very easy to prove. If you go back to the original proposition that the effect of the Earth is the same as if you were in a spaceship. You might ask yourself the same question. Inside a spaceship, I am inside a spaceship, and I throw something up and it come down again. How shall it move so that the reading on it is as big as possible? But the spaceship is really accelerating. And the moment I threw it up, it's moving at a uniform speed. And we know that's the right answer in empty space, a uniform speed. So a uniform speed as seen by something accelerating up, which is this, bing, bing, is the right answer. And that's how you can prove that what I said is true. It's sort of backwards, a little hard for you to get right away, but if you think about it, you may understand it.
A couple of questions.
Yes, sir.
First of all, back in another course I had, it was shown that there is no twin paradox when you include relativity.
Yes.
Well,
when you don't.
There is.
Well, it depends what you mean by twin paradox.
Yeah.
Now, let me just make a statement,
okay.
A physical statement. complete, and whether it's a paradox or not is up to you, but the following I believe to be true.
Okay.
Ready? I have two twins, if you want.
Yeah.
And one stands here, and another stands here, and they're together.
Yeah.
Okay. One is, they separate from each other for one reason or another. Well, let's say they move apart, and then finally they come back together again. All right?
Yeah.
During this motion, one twin has never felt any forces inside of his box.
The one that's standing up.
Well, that's the definition.
Yeah.
One has not felt any, we suppose, that one has not found himself thrown to the back wall or anything. The other one has.
Yeah.
The one who has felt himself thrown against the walls of his spaceship or his box is the one whose time will be younger than the one who doesn't feel that. Yeah, that's the statement. Now, that's correct statement, that no matter which way you analyze it, by gravity or whatever it is, it gives it right. Because I didn't say this guy was standing still, because if it was gravity, he's freely falling.
Yeah.
So on. And it gives, in that form, is physical, and it also distinguishes the two twins in a unique way, and there's no asymmetry paradox. It may be you don't like the idea that the time is different.
Well, this hasn't bothered me.
All right, that doesn't,
this kind of an idea bothers
me. Good, that's fine. Well, that's not what the paradox used to be, is it's unsymmetrical.
Yeah.
People who felt that relativity, who felt that the principle of relativity, that all motion is relative, which is not the principle. It's only uniform velocity in a straight line.
Right.
That this man who moved away and came back, he could, from the other point of view, think that guy moved away and came back, and so it should be symmetric. But the man who turns around is physically in a different condition. In fact, he can tell by much simpler experiments, namely he gets squashed against the back wall.
Yeah.
Then comes the general theory, and they say, well, it should be general with accelerations and gravity, but you'll find out that as far as the fellas feel things inside the spaceships, it's exactly the same.
Yeah.
And you can do the problem either way. You can either have him accelerating or being pulled by a gravity field. If he's pulled by a gravity field, he doesn't feel any. This guy could go away and be pulled by gravity while this one stands still and come back.
Yeah.
But when he's pulled by gravity, he doesn't feel anything.
Yeah.
When the gravity's turned on, this guy gets smashed against the back wall.
Yeah.
And then this one should be later than this one because he's further away. And that's right, he is later.
Yeah.
The other one's early. So it checks. So either way, you get the same answer if you state it that way. That's finally the way I finally found to get rid of all these guys.
Okay, one other question.
Yeah.
I have an electron that's sitting still here on Earth.
Yeah.
It's accelerating, essentially, because it's in gravity.
Yes.
But it doesn't radiate, or does it?
That's right, it doesn't radiate.
But it's accelerating.
That's right.
Well,
it's accelerating from a certain point of view, you mean? I mean, I could imagine that it's accelerating.
Yeah.
Yes. That's right. And the formula that the rate of acceleration of a charge is given by 2/3 e squared over c cubed is wrong. The right formula for the rate of radiation, the rate at which energy is lost by a charge, really comes out to 2/3 e squared over c cubed times the velocity times the rate of change of the acceleration with respect to time. That's the right formula. Now, if its acceleration is constant, as it is in the case of gravity, there, and independent of time, then there is no radiation. But this formula is also the same by mathematics as ddt of va, as you can see, minus, I got a sign wrong, excuse me. I always get a sign wrong. Minus the vdt times a, which is a squared. So people usually use a squared because for any cyclic motion or any periodic motion, any motion which comes back to zero velocity at the end from initial, it's just a difference in VA between initial and final condition, which this gives, which in cyclic motions and atoms and so on, where it goes around, it averages to zero in the long run, and nobody's very seriously worried about the exact moment and when the radiation radiated and so on. And the only place you ever need the VA to put it back is for this particular case of an electron which is accelerating all the time. If you work out the motion according to a theory of Maxwell's equations, even, for a particle which is accelerating with a constant acceleration forever, there's no radiation.
So the man in the spaceship carrying an electron wouldn't see
it. Well, it depends now which way. Is this electron accelerating or not along with the
electron accelerating together with constant acceleration,
They will radiate, yes. Oh, constant forever. That's right. Constant forever. No. He'll notice the radiation when his acceleration changes. That's right. He notices the radiation when the acceleration changes.
Yeah. You might expect maybe his average, his total, or the whole time, might average zero.
Well, it's all during the, when the acceleration is constant, is when, you see what happened. If you look at this VA, the V times the A, is that if you have a constant acceleration, then the velocity at the beginning and the end is different. And if you wait too long, it gets bigger and bigger and worse and worse. In other words, you're going to have to pay the piper at the end. You can't accelerate forever in a real spaceship. Sooner or later, you got to turn the damn thing off. When you do, you get one heck of a difference in that turn. So the acceleration occurs at the beginning and end of the motion. It's quite a complicated thing, but those are the smaller and higher class paradoxes that we're talking about. There are lower level paradoxes which you have to get past first.